Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Sullivan. On the program today, from leading the pack to dead last.
Canada was once a leader in the fight against climate change. However, after a series of missed opportunities, it has become the worst performer of all G7 nations since the landmark Paris Agreement on climate change was adopted in 2015.
The worst performer in the G7 consistently failed to meet its targets. Harsh words from that man, the Environment Commissioner, in a new report today. How did Canada fall so far behind in the fight against climate change? Why are we consistently failing to meet the targets? We will get answers from that man, the new Environmental Commissioner, Jerry DeMarco, and then the Natural Resources Minister and the former Environment Minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, will respond. Plus, a permanent military leader at last, but can he end the scandals?
General Eyre and I will continue to work hard in reforming the culture of the Canadian Armed Forces. Report to this
command. General Wayne Eyre is appointed at last as the permanent chief of the defense staff. How will he tackle military misconduct, especially now that almost 19,000 claims have been filed in a massive class action lawsuit over sexual misconduct in the military? Almost 19,000. What's the way forward? The defense minister, Anita Anand, will join us on that. And we'll also ask her about the military's help in the province of BC as they brace for more storms. And the Greens appoint a new interim leader.
I think I do bring a very unique perspective, and I would like to focus on the lived experiences and the perspective that it's given me on our societies.
30-year-old astrophysicist Amita Kuttner becomes the first trans person to take the reins of a federal party, but how will they repair the deep divisions within that party? Have they faced the kind of discrimination former leader Annamie Paul faced? We'll talk to the interim leader coming up on the program. All that plus the U.S. hits Canada with new softwood lumber tariffs. Is Joe Biden suddenly Canada's bad next-door neighbor? We'll dig into that. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Canada has gone from failure to failure on climate action, that according to a new report from Canada's Environment Watchdog. If the Commissioner's environmental assessment was considered a report card, Canada would be at the bottom of the class. According to the Commissioner, Canada has, quote, consistently failed to meet its emissions targets, and it's become the worst performer of all the G7 nations since the Paris Climate Accord was adopted in 2015. Reminder, in 2015, the then newly elected Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made the Paris Climate Change Summit one of his first big international trips. And it was in Paris when Prime Minister Trudeau declared, quote, Canada is back and here to help. Is that true? Well, 6 years later, Canada has committed to reducing emissions by 40 to 45%. But today's report found that Canada has consistently failed to meet its climate targets. So when it comes to climate, does Canada talk a big game and not follow up with the walk? Let's bring in Canada's Environment and Sustainable Development Commissioner, Jerry DeMarco. Sir, good to have you, Commissioner, on the program. You said Canada was going to, from, quote, failure to failure, worst performer of all the G7 countries since the 2015 Paris climate. What's gone wrong, sir? I think you're on mute. Just a commish. Hang on. Can we hear the commish? I don't think we can. Hang on. It's a technical issue. And maybe this is a metaphor for how you set the right targets on climate, but then you actually can't get the action. So we've got the words. Commish, just try again, and we'll see if we can get you. Are you there? Okay. You know what I'll do? Stay with us, Commissioner. I want you to stay here. We're going to effort a fix. What I'm going to do is I'll bring on the former Environment Minister and now the Natural Resources Minister, Minister Wilkinson, and then we'll go back to the Environmental Watchdog, but we know what the report said, so let me bring in Minister Wilkinson. Minister Wilkinson, what is your response to the Environment Commissioner report saying Canada's been the worst in the G7 fighting climate since 2015 when your government was first elected?
Well, I would say, look, the report actually looks back over 30 years, and I think up until 2015, it's fair to say that Canada was a climate laggard. I mean, we went through 10 years of Stephen Harper where almost nothing was done on climate change. Where I probably would differ a little bit with the commissioner is, and where I would actually also agree with him, let me start with agreement, is there's a lot of work to do on implementation. There's no question that there's a lot to do on implementation. But what I would say is the Pan-Canadian Framework and after it the Strengthened Climate Plan are one of the most detailed climate plans that exist anywhere in the world. If you're going to implement something, if you're going to actually focus on not just saying you're going to do something, but you're going to actually focus on implementing it, you need detailed plans across every sector of the economy. Right. And that's exactly what we have in the Strengthened Climate Plan. It starts with a price on pollution. It goes through the phasing out of coal and the clean fuels regulation. But it's all in that plan.
Minister, but hang on. I don't want to just dismiss it. You're right, it goes back 30 years, but I'm going to read you from the report. Canada has become the worst performer of all the G7 nations, I'm reading the report here, since the Paris Agreement was adopted in 2015. So in the 6 years since your government's been in power, Canada's been the worst. And the commissioner's very explicit. It's not for lack of plans and targets, it's lack of implementation. So I know you're blaming Stephen Harper, but you got to take, it's been 6 years of the Trudeau government. What has gone wrong?
Well, first of all, that's just not true. And I don't think any other country in the G7 would tell you that. And in fact, the head of the IEA would tell you exactly the reverse, which is Canada has been the most ambitious and the leader on this. What we came into power with was a projection that Canada's emissions would be 12% above the 2005 level by 2030 if nothing was done. We have broken that trajectory. Canada's emissions now are 1% below the 2005 level. We provided a detailed plan that provides in every sector of the economy how we're going to achieve the emissions reductions. Clean Prosperity just came out and said, if we implement all of that, and we have to do that, we will meet our targets. Professor Jacquard at SFU has said the same thing. Andrew Weaver, who is an eminent climate scientist and a green politician, has said the same thing.
But again, the commissioner's point is not that you don't have a plan, it's will you implement it. And again, I know you're saying it's false. I'm going to read you, I got his report here, so I'm going to read you the clip of it. Canada's greenhouse gas emissions have increased since the Paris Climate Agreement was signed, making it the worst performer in the G7 since the 20. So they're actually gone up. He does say there was some progress decoupling emissions from population growth and GDP, right? Because that's grown faster than emissions. He says that. But he says our emissions have gone up faster than any other in the G7. So, like, are you saying he's factually wrong?
No, I'm saying he's using a different frame. He's using just the absolute emissions. What I'm saying to you is if you looked at where Canada's emissions were going in 2015, they were going significantly up. They were actually going to be 12% above 2005 levels in 2030. The first thing you have to do is change that trajectory. The second thing, which we have done, the second thing you have to do is have a plan that's actually going to step through the ways in which to reduce emissions, many of which actually take a number of years, the price on pollution, the phasing out of coal by 2030, the implementation over the next couple of years of the clean fuel standard, the building out of refueling infrastructure. But what I will tell you is thoughtful observers, experts across this country that have looked at the plan have said if we implement everything that we've said we're going to do in the plans, we will achieve our targets. And I agree with the commissioner that we have to implement those. It's important that people continue to push us to ensure that we're implementing them. But we have a plan that will achieve a target that is 1.5 right. degree aligned.
But if it's achieved and if it's followed through. But the commissioner also points out something called the Emissions Reduction Fund, okay, set up in 2020. Set up by Natural Resources Department, which now you lead as the minister. Yep. It was meant to reduce emissions, methane emissions, and also oil and gas. But the commissioner says it wasn't designed well, it wasn't implemented well, it was not designed to ensure credible and sustainable reductions of greenhouse gas emissions in the oil and gas sector or value for money spent. So it was close to $700 million. He calls it hastily put together. Was that program a failure, and are you going to dismantle it?
So the commissioner and I discussed this yesterday, and I agree with a number of the points that he made, which is if you were setting up this program as an ongoing program, you would certainly set it up differently than it was established. But this program was set up as a COVID support measure. It was actually about supporting workers and communities, ensuring that you maintained employment during a period where energy prices were at record lows. It was about ensuring that companies that were in great financial stress continued to invest in methane reduction, which they would not have been able to do absent this program. And while it's $670 million, it's only about $150 million that's actually been spent thus far. So it did what it was intended to do. There's about 5 megatons in reductions. It supported employment. But I think the commissioner is absolutely right. And in fact, before I actually saw his report and spoke to him, I had already told the department that we need to look at what we are going to do with respect to the program going forward, because it no longer is needed in terms of supporting the oil and gas sector and maintaining employment.
Okay, so some are saying actually this program did the exact opposite. It actually increased emissions.
Well, no. Again, it depends a little bit on your frame. But what I would say to you is, in a crisis where many of these companies were on the verge of bankruptcy, they were not going to be investing in emissions reductions that are required under the regulations. What this was intended to do was to enable them to actually continue to do the work that we need them to do to achieve the methane reductions. But it was also about supporting workers and communities. And look, if you go talk to the mayors of almost every small community across Western Canada, they will tell you this was an amazingly important COVID support program.
Well, I mean, as you say, only $150 million was spent on it, but the question is, was it well spent? Can I just quickly, while I have you, Minister, the U.S. is going to double duties on Canadian softwood lumber to 17.9%. This is kind of stunning, because the Prime Minister was just meeting with Joe Biden. Joe Biden said this is a great and easy relationship. Now we've got Buy American duties. We've got this issue on electric cars where they want to have a tax credit of $12,500 for electric cars built in the U.S. that could really, really hurt the auto industry in Ontario. Now they're taking a shot, by the way, at softwood lumber, 17.9%. First of all, what is Canada? Will Canada retaliate against the U.S., and what is going on here?
Well, I would say absolutely the American action is outrageous, and certainly we need to ensure that we are standing up for Canadian companies and workers and communities on an ongoing basis, both with respect to the forestry sector, but also as you reflected with respect to the auto sector. I mean, look, the Americans, this administration, we see eye to eye on a number of issues, including fighting climate change. But Americans are Americans and Canadians are Canadians, and we are always going to have to ensure that our interests are represented, well represented, because their job is to focus on
theirs. So will we retaliate? Like, and I get it, but will we retaliate? Because, I mean, now it's autos, and we're worried about Line 5. I know they canceled Keystone. You know, Joe Biden's not exactly been economically friendly to Canada. Now softwood lumber doubles. This is really bad news. I just, real straight answer, is Canada prepared to retaliate?
All options are on the table at this point. I mean, we're going to be pursuing legal action through NAFTA or CUSMA. We are certainly looking at all options in the same way that we did with steel and aluminum, where we did actually retaliate, and it was part of actually getting to an outcome that was a good outcome for Canada. So we're going to stand up for Canadian interests, and we're going to do that through all of the most effective means possible.
Oh, Natural Resource Minister, Mr. Wilkinson, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Evan.
We have fixed the technical problems with Canada's Environment and Sustainable Development Commissioner, Jerry DeMarco. So he's been listening in and he's back. Commissioner, great to have you back. I think we got the audio. You just heard Minister Wilkinson. He took umbrage with some of what you said. I said, well, you said Canada's the worst performer in the G7 nation since the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. He said, no, that's not true. What's your take?
Well, first, thanks for having me back. It was a bad timing to reach net zero on my microphone emissions, but so be it. Canada is the worst performer since 2015 on emissions. Look, we're looking at the actual results. Have emissions gone down? No, they've gone up in Canada. They've gone down in five of the other six G7 nations, and the one other one that did have an increase had an increase that was lower than ours. So we are the worst performer since that time, yes.
Okay, so he says we're not, and he said everyone says their plan is the best, and he said if we need a plan to implement, they've got the plan since 2015, and it will be implemented. What's your response to when they say, look, we've got a plan, and it's working, and we've had to make up lost ground, but we've really got it this time?
Well, we've had 30 years of lost ground. I agree with that. We have a plan. We'll have an updated plan in December or March from the federal government. That's all good. The point of my report today is to say we have to learn from the past. A history of failure and then failure and then failure needs to be replaced with success, and that means results that are decreases in emissions.
Does the new plan that Minister Wilkinson and Minister Guilbeault have outlined, has the new plan 40% reductions by 2030, does this plan give you any confidence that it actually is realistic, or we won't keep, quote, as you described, missing our targets?
Well, the point is to learn from history and not to repeat past failures. So there are some positives. I'm not saying that the plan's going to fail. I haven't audited the new plan. I'm just providing a 30-year retrospective on what's come to date, with the hope that the 8 lessons learned in our report will be applied moving forward and that the plan works. To be frank, this plan isn't the plan. There's going to be a new plan in December or March under the Net Zero Act. We'll evaluate that plan after it comes out. For the time being, we want to just emphasize that we need to shift towards results. The temperature of the planet is correlated with emissions and concentrations of gases in the atmosphere, not good intentions.
Okay, well, that's the question. How do we decide what's good intentions and what's not? Your office audited the government's emissions reduction fund that they set up in 2020 as part of a COVID support program. How would you describe how that worked?
Well, if this is a program intended to reduce emissions, then the department should have been able to show to us its results in reducing net emissions. And I don't just mean the narrow emissions that they chose to look at in this program. If they were reducing emissions at one part of a facility, but having the rest of the facility increase production, that's a net increase, not a net decrease. As I said, the atmosphere responds to actual emissions, not just narrow accountings of partial emissions.
Can you just break that down again? I want people to understand that, because I just put that to the former Environment Minister, now the Minister of Natural Resources, Minister Wilkinson. And he said, depends which way you look at it. We actually believe it helped and reduced emissions of methane. You're saying it increased. I just wanted this to be clear. You're saying the program, which was a COVID support program meant to reduce methane emissions, actually ended up increasing emissions.
No, what I'm saying is we don't know the results of it because they only tracked a narrow segment of emissions. If they had tracked net emissions, we could tell you the answer to your question, but they did not. For example, projects applied for funding and gave numbers on the narrow emissions that they would be addressing without factoring in the increase in production or the fact that they would meet many of these emissions reductions through the operation of law anyway with the methane regulations. We wanted to know what this fund itself did to reduce emissions, and the department could not tell us that.
Okay, that's a fascinating report. Environment Commissioner Jerry DeMarco. Listen, I'm glad we solved the audio issues and we got to put some voice to it, so we didn't just have to do it in mime or anything, but great to have you on the program.
Great to be here, and thanks for your patience with that.
No problem. Thank you. That's the Commissioner for the Environment. Coming up, Canada finally gets a new permanent leader for the military. How does he deal with the military facing, here's the number we found out today, close to 19,000 claims of sexual misconduct that are involved now in a massive class action suit, almost 19,000. What is the way forward? What's the latest on the military's help in BC? The Defense Minister, Anita Anand, joins us next. Stay right here with Power Play. Canada's Defence Minister Anita Anand and the Prime Minister have announced the official appointment of General Wayne Eyre as the new permanent Chief of the Defence Staff. He had served as the acting chief since February, was promoted to general in August. He took over for Admiral Art MacDonald. Remember, MacDonald stepped aside 6 weeks into his role after the military police launched an investigation into a sexual assault allegation against him. No charges were ever laid against MacDonald. But today was also the deadline for past and current military members to join a class action lawsuit against the military over sexual misconduct. How many past and current members signed on? It's almost staggering. Almost 19,000, 57% of them female, over 30% poured in the last month. So what is the way forward here for the new Chief of the Defense Staff? And what's the latest out of BC with the military? Let's find out. Joining us now is the Defense Minister, Anita Anand. Minister, good to have you back on the program. I think the first time in your new role. General Wayne Eyre has been appointed the Chief of the Defense Staff. On the very same day that I was just saying, almost 19,000 past and current members have signed on to the sexual misconduct. What is the biggest challenge facing General Eyre?
Thanks, Evan, for having me on. The biggest challenges facing General Wayne Eyre as Chief of Defense Staff and me as Minister of National Defense is to address the crisis of culture in the Canadian Armed Forces. And in order for members to feel safe and protected and respected in doing their job, in serving their country, they need to have an environment in which they are treated fairly and their claims are heard in an impartial way. And that is exactly what Wayne Eyre and I will continue to work on.
How will he do it differently? This has been going on for a long time. At one point, I remember the Prime Minister and Minister Freeland said the military leaders just don't get it. How do you know General Eyre gets it?
It's a good question, and indeed it is one that I have thought about a lot over the last 4 weeks as I have been the Minister of National Defense. I have worked with Wayne Eyre every day during that time and had many conversations with him regarding his commitment to what is my top priority and a top priority of our government, which is to ensure that members of the Canadian Armed Forces, when they put on their uniform, feel safe, feel respected, feel protected in the execution of their duties. And that is something that General Eyre and I will continue to work on.
What does it tell you that yesterday was the deadline for Canadian Armed Forces, the Department of Defense personnel, to submit claims in the settlement of a class action lawsuit against the federal government for sexual misconduct in the military? According to the website, 18,805 claims. I don't know about you, but that kind of stunned me. What does it tell you about that, and how do you deal with that vast number, Minister?
Well, Evan, I will say that I came into this role in order to address the plight of victims and survivors of sexual assault. And I have been working on that every single day. The 19,000 or so members that you point to are those who have filed claims. And we know that the crisis of culture within the Canadian military extends even beyond that number. So this is an important, indeed crucial issue that we need to address given the crisis of confidence that members themselves feel and that therefore Canadians at large are very concerned with. The addressing the crisis of culture in the Canadian Armed Forces is not going to be fixed overnight. This is going to be a very long process. But rest assured, as I showed on November 4th, by ensuring that sexual misconduct allegations in terms of investigations and prosecutions will be moved from the military justice system to the civil system, that's just the first step. We need to keep working on this. Bill C-77, Declaration of Victims' Rights, the investment that we are making, $236 million from budget 2021 into addressing sexual misconduct in the military, and indeed the reform of the military justice system that I just mentioned. Those are all parts of this, but I need to make sure that we have institutions in place, and General Wayne Eyre will be committed to that with me.
Just two things real quick before I move on, Minister. Look, there was clearly a vetting problem in the military before. General Vance, what the allegations against General Vance, I know he denies them, but obviously they were missed in the vetting process. Admiral Art MacDonald, who, by the way, wants his job back, he told CTV, and you can comment on that, but he obviously, there was a miss on that. Was there a different, new, and more rigorous vetting process of the past on General Eyre than the former CDS has had?
Well, of course, the appointment of the Chief of Defense Staff is one that the Prime Minister makes. It is an at-pleasure appointment and confirmed by order in council. And indeed, when I came into this role, I definitely voiced my concern that appointments may be made in a rigorous and very, I would say, fulsome way, comprehensive way, and I will continue to voice my views on that.
I'm going to interpret that there was a more rigorous vetting process. Is that fair to say?
I've been in the role for 4 weeks, and I will say that for my own part, I needed to make sure that General Eyre would be committed to addressing the crisis of culture that I previously described in this interview. And after working alongside with him for the past 4 weeks, I believe that he is committed to the same goal that I am as his top priority.
Department of National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces are still planning to issue an apology for the victims of military misconduct. The plaintiffs in the settlement requested that. When will they see it?
That we are planning will occur, if all goes well, prior to the end of the year, and we are in the final planning stages to ensure that that occurs. I feel very strongly that the victims and those who filed under this class action suit do receive an apology, and we look forward to ensuring that that occurs.
Okay, an apology coming before the end of the year. There's been a report out, I think it's Canadian Press, I hope I'm attributing that right, that in the quest to replace Canada's aging Air Force fleet, that the Boeing Super Hornet CF-18 has been knocked out of the competition, didn't meet the qualifications. Now it's only the Lockheed Martin F-35 and the Saab aircraft that are contributing. Can you confirm that Boeing is now no longer in the running or not?
Well, Evan, let me just explain that the process for choosing the successful bidders under the process is being run in Public Services and Procurement Canada's department, and that is deliberately the case so that there is no political involvement. So for further questions, I would say that you should direct them there. As Minister of National Defense, I am confident that they will do the work that they need to ensure a fair and equitable result in terms of that competition.
Okay, yeah, $19 billion contract, so that's a big one. Minister, just before you go, the military, the men and women in the military are in British Columbia helping out. They're expecting, obviously, three more storms. It's a devastating situation. Can you tell us how long the military is there for and maybe the latest update of what they're doing to prep for what could be, I guess, three more and very dangerous storms?
Thank you, Evan. Yes, it is a very dire situation, and it is all hands on deck for the Canadian Armed Forces in British Columbia. We have over 500 soldiers on the ground in British Columbia. We have thousands more that are ready to go into British Columbia should the need arise, and we are working closely with the provincial government and local authorities on evaluating those needs. But rest assured, we stand ready with immediate response units across the country to make sure that we can go into British Columbia as the need arises. In terms of what they're working on, sandbagging, unclogging drainage, ensuring that livestock are rescued, and indeed doing reconnaissance in the air to ensure that roadways can remain open. Those are all the types of activities that are going on, but it is a dire situation. We are following it by the minute, and we are really making sure that we are there for the people of British Columbia.
Yeah, men and women of the military are working incredibly hard in BC. Okay, Minister, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Evan. Take care.
All right, so lots on the table there. Apology coming within the year. Really interesting about the new appointment there. But coming up, the Green Party has a new leader, and they're breaking barriers. Amita Kuttner makes history becoming Canada's youngest and the first transgender and the first person of East Asian descent to lead a federal party. How do they bring that party together, though, after the inner turmoil and a disastrous election? They join us next. Stay with us. Welcome back. A new leader is stepping in to take over the Green Party's helm, the 30-year-old astrophysicist who specializes in studying black holes. Amita Kuttner has a big job ahead, healing a party that was publicly ripped apart during the tenure of Annamae Paul, who stepped down after the devastating results in the last elections. The Green Party is essentially broke. They're down a seat. So how does Kuttner fix it? And have they, as the first trans person and the first person of East Asian descent to lead a party, faced the kind of discrimination in that party that Annamae Paul described that she faced. Well, a party leadership contest needs to get underway within 6 months of an interim leader's appointment. So how much change can Amita Kuttner actually make? Let's find out. They join us now. First of all, congratulations on the job. This is a big thing. You're taking over the leadership of the Green Party in a moment of crisis. I know you're an astrophysicist and you specialize in black holes. Politically speaking, the Greens are in a black hole. Like, what are you doing and how are you going to fix it?
Well, you know, I think it's up to all the members of the party to work together to fix it. And maybe this will sound as green as possible, but I want to do it through love, through caring for one another, for caring for people and showing that we can rebuild trust.
There has not been a lot of love. Let's be candid. Anna Meepal resigned as leader after the bad election results. She said, I experienced racism. I experienced sexism. She said she was undermined. And she said that party is riven with, I mean, racism, anti-Semitism, sexism. What has your experience been now that you're the interim leader? Have you experienced anything like that?
Well, I can say that since I took this job less than 24 hours ago, I have not experienced any. But I have experienced discrimination within the party, but I think it's a reflection of the wider society. I don't think it's particular to the party. I also think it's a very small fraction of the membership that this is coming from. You know, we live in a country founded on colonialism, white supremacy, patriarchy, among other things, and that defines the way that our systems and certainly our political parties are built and function. So it's there. And what determines what happens is how we respond to it. And that's the question and the problem we're in now.
Okay, but I just want to be specific because Anna Meepal was specific. You said you faced discrimination. And again, because you're the first non-binary or trans person to lead a federal party, which, by the way, also makes history, as she made history as the first black woman to lead a party. What specifically have you faced inside the Green Party? Can you give us some ideas of what was it about?
Yeah, so it's about every piece of my identity. I honestly don't like focusing on it. I want to talk about the work, but it is relevant. It's a matter of representation. I'm honored to be here for those firsts, I suppose. But I've experienced direct racist comments. I've experienced a lot of transphobia, mostly during the leadership race, done directly to my face. And this is, you know, anywhere from mild things like a misunderstanding of the existence of my identity to very dehumanizing direct attacks on my existence and my, you know, stability.
The reason I'm focusing on it, and I think it's really important here, because I don't think identity should be the lead. You're the leader of a political party. But it was because when Anna Meepal really had opened up this door to say within the Green Party, these issues undermined her leadership. And she said it was the worst experience of her life. And now when you tell me that you've experienced that over your identity, what does that tell you about the Green Party? If people, as you're running to be interim leader, you're facing that kind of open and very personal transphobia, what does that tell you?
It tells me that the Green Party is still an existing part of our political structure. For the most part, the people that have said these things to me are not in leadership positions in the party. They're not, certainly not in the staff, and they're certainly not in the elected caucus. So the people that I've worked with, I really haven't come upon this. But it exists in the membership because the membership is just a subsection of the larger population. And within that, you're going to find people who have been trained. They're not intending, as far as I know, to directly cause harm, though I think it has gotten to that recently. Not on me yet, but it has gotten to that recently. It's about a misunderstanding of each other and not knowing where we're coming from and our inability to get through those communication barriers.
What is the most urgent issue you have to deal with right off the bat in a party that's broke, riven with divisions, and they got to get back on track?
I would definitely say it's the broke part, and we are going to be fundraising.
That's the most urgent, fundraising. And you got to unify people, which is other thing. The other thing I just want to mention, because I want people to get to know you, because you're a national leader now, climate change obviously is more than just a key issue in the Green Party. It's very personal to you. And I just think of what's happening in your province of British Columbia now, the mudslides, and the flooding. And I want people to know this is very personal to you because in 2005, you lost your mom. Your dad was badly injured. You lost your home 14 years ago to a mudslide in North Vancouver, which must have been unimaginably. Can you tell us what happened, and if watching what's happening in BC is opening, frankly, the most painful chapter of your life up again?
Yes, it is. And it was very interesting trying to put an application together for this position while all that was going on, because that's what we need to be dealing with. And so it was so clear what our work is actually about. So what happened to me, I think it was almost 17 years ago now, 2005. And it was in January of 2005 that there was an atmospheric river and came, hit North Vancouver. And due to a number of circumstances, some of which were actually government issues in allowing houses to be built there in the first place, and also an unstable slope that then did not get stabilized as required, it caused my house to be hit by a mudslide that came from the hill behind it and wiped it out entirely. Had I been home, I would have lost my life. I was away in boarding school in California, and my mother died. My father was in the bathtub because he had been cleaning up the basement from flooding, and he heard a noise and stood up, so his head was above the mud, and he managed to survive, though seriously injured.
I am so sorry that I have to deal with this, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being able to talk about it. I know it's not easy, and public life demands that you sort of share these things, and that's one of the big costs of it, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Amita Kuttner, you got a big job ahead over the next 6 months. I look forward to many more conversations, and from what's going on in your own backyard in BC to your own party, please come back on the program. Thanks for joining us, and good luck in the new job.
Thank you very much.
Amita Kuttner, she's the interim there, the interim leader of the Green Party of Canada. Coming up, the U.S. doubles down on their duty tariffs on softwood lumber, nearly 18%. Check this out.
This is an issue that we take very seriously. We will continue to defend our workers and our forestry sector.
Okay. Is Joe Biden basically undermining Canada's economy, now softwood lumber? The press gallery with special guest Lisa Raitt will take that up next. Stay with us. Welcome back. Another U.S. blow to Canada. The U.S. Department of Commerce doubled the tariff rate on most of Canada's softwood lumber. After a review of their anti-dumping orders on certain softwood lumber products from Canada, the U.S. is raising the levy to almost 19%. That's up from nearly 9%. That is a killer blow. The states accuse Canadian lumber producers of dumping their subsidized products into this country at a lower price, making American producers less competitive, despite historical friendly relations. By the way, this goes back decades. They've been doing this forever. This is actually a new escalation of it. The softwood lumber dispute is one of the most enduring sticking points between the countries. Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland today said Canada will retaliate, potentially, if it has to, as they did under Trump, with steel and aluminum. But with failures to make gains over Buy American, the Line 5 pipeline, this electric car vehicle tax credit that the Biden administration wants to give to cars, electric cars produced in the United States, $12,500, that would be devastating to the auto industry in Ontario. Is the Biden administration walking all over Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government? Well, the press gallery is here. Joyce Napier is CTV News Ottawa Bureau Chief. Robert Benzie is Toronto Star's Queen's Park Bureau Chief, and our special guest, I don't know if she's a Bureau Chief. You got to be a Bureau Chief to get on the panel today. Lisa Raitt, the former Conservative Natural Resources Minister. Now, oh, she's just the Vice Chair of Global Investment Banking at CIBC. She's not a Bureau Chief. She's just
a
Vice Chief. Nothing. Lisa, how big a blow is this from the Biden administration?
It's pretty big. Look, one of the best things that happened to me when I was natural resources minister was the fact that David Emerson had negotiated a deal on softwood lumber. So it wasn't an irritant in any time that I was there. But I can tell you, this has a massive effect on British Columbia, a massive effect on New Brunswick, but also an impact on the United States domestic economy itself. They can only supply 75% of what their demand is. They have to come to Canada. And that's going to hit affordability, the cost of homes, the cost of renovations. So if they're worried about affordability in the U.S., which they should be, this just doesn't make any sense.
Joyce, kind of interesting here. Joe Biden said, you know, Canada is the easiest relationship. Boy, like with friends like these, what do you make of this?
Well, listen, the relationship was always a little bit like that. I remember in 2003, I was in Washington, D.C. at the Canadian Embassy, and the announcement was, hey, we reached a settlement on softwood lumber, and we all naively thought, oh, good, we don't have to cover it anymore. You know, what, six disputes later, here we are again talking about it. Look, Donald Trump did the same thing. He increased it to 20% and then went back down to 9%. The only solace that, you know, Canada can feel right now is that trade tribunals always give Canada, always, you know, decide in favor of Canada on these disputes. But, they, you know, they last a long time. This one may last till 22, 23. They will reach a settlement because they always do. But does that speak to the kind of relationship we have? We expected that from Donald Trump. You know, you don't expect, it hurts probably more the Canadian soul because it is Joe Biden. You expected something like that, you know, like a kick in the teeth from Donald Trump, but this is definitely a kick in the teeth. And, you know, like Lisa said, 70% of the softwood lumber the Americans produce themselves, but 30% they need it imported. So somewhere it's going to ricochet on the American economy as well. So why they keep doing this and why they keep maintaining the same thing and why they keep losing in front of all these trade tribunals is, you know, a question we should ask them.
Well, first of all, the cost of their housing, Benz, is going to go up, first of all. Second of all, yeah, they lose at trade tribunals, but they don't care because that takes time. Biden gets a political win. Yeah. They already destroy the forestry industry here. They hurt our producers. And then in a couple years, they lose and they go back again. So we know this movie. We've seen it before. It's a crappy movie. What does it tell us, though?
Yeah, it's a tedious movie. And to Joyce's point, I remember that in 2003 and thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad we're not going to hear about this again and again and again. And it keeps coming back. Paul Bunyan, you know, like this crazy, you know, zombie that we can't kill. But it also speaks to the power of the U.S. lumber lobby in Washington. So I think that that's what this is about. I'm here in Ontario. I'm more concerned, frankly, about these $12,500 tax credits for American-built electric vehicles. That's going to directly impact us in this province. We've got a Chrysler factory in Brampton with 3,100 employees. They make gas-powered muscle cars, the Dodge Challenger, the Dodge Charger, and the Chrysler 300. And that factory may close after 2023 because the next vehicle that's going to be replacing it is an EV. And they're talking about building it in Belvedere, Illinois, because to take advantage of those tax credits. So the Ontario government's very worried about that. The Canadian government's very worried about that. And they should be because the auto industry is very important to this province.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by the way to go dropping a Paul Bunyan reference, who was a Canadian folk hero. But, of course, the Americans adopted him. That's why we've shifted over to Big Joe Muffera, okay? So you got to drop Big Joe Muffera. Lisa, how do they fight? This is my lumberjack trivia here. Lisa, how do they fight back here? Like, is it time to retaliate?
I just wish they would just go negotiate. I mean, let's try to get something, at least in the interim. The retaliation isn't going to help. It's going to hurt us. And we've done it before, and it's been ineffectual. So I'd like to see them try to negotiate. I know that the Forestry Product Association is talking to their counterparts in the United States. They're talking to congressmen. They're talking to congresswomen about the issue. And the issue has to resonate with them that you're just driving up your own costs, guys, and that's a political loser for you because look what has already happened in the last two governor elections, how tight they were on the basis of affordability.
Yeah, Joyce, they retaliated on steel, they retaliated on aluminum, and they say that worked under the Trump. Is it time to escalate with Biden?
Well, it may be time, but perhaps, you know, before you do that, before you escalate, look, the lumber industry in the United States is saying, why don't we sit down and negotiate? You know, experts on this side are saying, yeah, even if you do, this is going to go on till 2022, 2023. So this will linger, and it will hurt, because it always does. Even if after, you know, you settle it, you get, you know, retroactive reimbursements or whatever it is, the deal will be. You know, maybe retaliation is, maybe it is the answer. But it's sure. Look, we were in Washington last week. We followed the prime minister to Washington. The Canadians came away with really nothing much gained there. And, you know, to what Benzie was saying about the $12,500 tax credit for electric vehicles, you know, the president remained very vague, saying, well, it's going through Congress. Let's see. You know, he kind of kicked the can down the road. But the White House spokesman said, no, guys, wait a minute. The president really likes this. So, you know, look, it's that kind of relationship, and we're living next to a bully. Let's say it. We like them sometimes, but, you know, it's a tough relationship.
Benz, I got 30 seconds for you to chime in on that, on the future on the auto industry. What do they do?
It's going to be very, very tough. They make 1 million cars a year in Ontario. They want to make 400,000 EVs in this province within the next decade or so, a year. And we have to have a market for them, and that market is the United States. So if the Americans have a subsidy that is advantageous to American-built cars and disadvantages Canadian-built cars, that's a big problem for us. So the Prime Minister Trudeau has his work cut out for him, because Joe Biden has to concern himself with domestic political considerations. He's not necessarily worried about making Justin Trudeau happy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I got to leave it there. You know what I love? That I can talk to you and you're all experts on softwood lumber. The file you never wanted to know this well. Robert Benzie, Lisa Raitt, and Joyce Napier. It's true. All Canadians know about it. All right. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for watching, everyone. We are going to be back here in 23 short hours. Remember, hug your loved ones. Never take that for granted. Have a great evening, and thanks for watching.